Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Price of Football podcast. Here we're at week three already, doesn't time fly? My name is Kevin Day, and with me, as always, is football finance expert Kieran Maguire from the University of Liverpool. And this is the pod which follows the money behind our beautiful game. Hello, Kieran, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you, Kevin.
Good, safe journey down?
Very good, yes, yeah. Good. Trains are fantastic.
Now, they are, aren't they? We couldn't have said that 20 years ago, going to away games. Last week we talked about Mike Ashley and Newcastle. And we tried unsuccessfully then to make a case for the defence. This week, and again, I know a lot of people have told us there are divisions outside the Premier League, and we will be covering them in depth, and we'll be covering the whole game in depth in both England and Scotland. But there's one team that we're a similar age. We support very, very different teams, which is a big, big issue. I wish somebody had told me in some of the emails before we started this that you were a Brighton fan, but it's done now. We can't do anything about that, really, except put you in a time machine and teach you some sense. But yeah, that's not going to happen. But in our time supporting football, one club in particular, and I apologise to Liverpool and Man City fans, but one club in particular has dominated everything in English football pretty much. And despite its lack of success at the moment, still does. And that club is Manchester United, who have been, I think, I had an eye-opening experience when I did Match of the Day 2, and it's that my editor sent me to Torquay to go to Old Trafford on a coach full of Man United fans. And of course, I rubbed my hands together in glee, and he said, no, I want you to go there to expel this myth that all Man United fans are glory hunters, and because he had this theory that, you know, people supported Man United for valid reasons, right? And it turned out he was right, because on that coach there were people there who were from Manchester, there were people there whose parents had moved down for work, but also the Munich air crash, the European Cup, George Best, and also, to be fair, these were people that were getting on a coach at 4 o'clock in the morning to go to Manchester to support their team, and went to every home and away game. So I couldn't throw the glory hunters epithet at them, as many people do. But for many decades, United have been the focus of English football. You genuinely either love them, or you find very few people who are ambivalent about them. And they've always been considered a financial giant, a financial behemoth. They've always had the biggest sponsorship deals. They've always spent the biggest money on transfers. Steve Parrish himself will tell you that in their dealings with Palace, Zaha and Wan-Bissaka, they're very honourable. So my question for this pod is essentially, are Man United still the biggest club? Are they the draw they once were? Because you've got this situation where Ed Woodward, the CEO, on a weekly basis seems to find a reason to pronounce record profits or record something that financially, but yet on the pitch they are severely underperforming despite the amount of money they've paid on this team. It's a big question, I know, so you feel free. I'll have a cup of tea while you crack on.
Well, I think really we ought to start with the reign of the Glazers.
Right.
They took over Manchester United in 2005. They spent about £770 million on the club. And prior to that, United had no debt whatsoever.
None at all?
Nope. They had money in the bank. They didn't have a mortgage. Old Trafford was built. They were winning trophies every year under Sir Alex. They were able to outbid any other English club. So they were very successful.
And they had a sort of stable ownership as well, didn't they, at that time? And it wasn't, you wouldn't call it a family-run club, and you wouldn't call it like Bob Lord, who used to run Burnley, the local butcher who got lucky. But they had a sort of continuity of ownership for quite some time, didn't they? Before?
That's right. The Edwards family had been involved. They did bring them to the stock market, and that generated more cash for the club, which was then invested both on and off the pitch in terms of infrastructure and players. So everything was going pretty swimmingly. The Glazers came in and they took risk because if you borrow £770 million...
Sorry, can I interrupt you there, which again, I know it's a theme of the pub. Why, if the club was that well run and that successful at the time, why did they go to the Glazers or agree to sell to the Glazers?
Well, the Manchester United were on the stock market.
Right.
So if you're on the stock market...
You can't turn down somebody who... I understand.
That's right.
So I say I understand. I don't fully, but you know, for the purposes of moving on, I understand. I do genuinely understand. Yes.
If you've got a share which is £2.50 and somebody offers you £3,
yes,
everybody will sell. And that's what happened with the Glazers. And they continued to be reasonably successful.
The Glazers had the money to buy the club?
No, the Glazers didn't have a bean. The Glazers went to the banks and they bought. It's a bit like you or I taking out a 100% mortgage.
Me, yeah, not you. But you wouldn't do that.
but the bank said, well, we don't know who the Glazers are. And also, they're American banks and we're not exactly sure what soccer is. So what the bank started to do was they started to charge large amounts of interest. So
they borrowed money they didn't have against the club they were going to buy.
That's right.
Even I don't think that's a good business model, is it?
It's a good business model if the club generates enough cash to pay back the banks and to give money to the owners as well.
And United did or didn't do that?
They mainly gave it to the banks. Because since the Glazers acquired the club in 2005, they said they bought it for £770 million, the banks have earned £809 million in interest.
In interest?
In interest alone. And this is what upsets some of the United fans, because they feel that money should have gone into the pitch.
I don't blame them. That's in 14 years. What's that figure again?
£809 million.
In interest?
That's right.
Not in repayment, just in interest?
No, they still owe £500 million in outstanding loans. They still owe over £500 million.
The Glazers or Manchester United owe that money?
Manchester United owe the banks £500 million.
Holy Mary, really?
Yep.
I thought my eyebrow raising days were behind me. So well, that's. I knew that they borrowed money against the club. I had no idea the figures were that high. That's incredible. I suspect there might be some Man United fans that are alarmed by that. Is it a cause for alarm?
No, because it was. It was a cause for alarm in the first few years.
Right.
And that's why the bank said, well, we're not happy about this. The interest rates went up at one point to 16.25% on those loans. Now they're around about 3 or 4% because the stock market sees that United is just a cash cow. It's always generating enough money to pay the banks their interest, so everybody's happy.
And of course, these are American banks, aren't they? These are not your high street banks, are they? These are big.
That's right. They're the big American investment banks,
right.
And you know, HSBC and JP Morgan and all of that type of banks. They do their homework. They would not have lent that money if they weren't certain that they were going to get it back. I think initially they were worried, which is why they said, well, we're going to charge you extra amounts of interest because we think you're a little bit risky.
So the banks don't own Man United. The Glazers still own.
The Glazers own the shares.
Ah.
The banks own the debt.
You
put those two together.
So where would you fit? There's been a lot of talk recently, and rightly so, because I have been there at the Old Trafford. Parts of Old Trafford, in particular where you go down the Munich Air Tribute, absolutely beautiful, very moving. Parts of Old Trafford are quite shabby. It's looking its age, even though it's still a gorgeous stadium. So, two questions off the back of that. We know who owns the debt and who owns the shares. Who owns Old Trafford? And is there a reason why money's not being spent on it? Because they're not short of money for players. Because there's a lot of money for Maguire and a lot of money for Wan-Bissaka. Thank you very much. but I'm not entirely sure he's worth it. But Old Trafford is kind of getting a bit shabby. So why are they not spending money on Old Trafford, which is an iconic ground, whoever you support? It's one of the... You can't get round the fact that Man United, it's that classic cliche, you can find yourself in the remote jungles of Africa and somebody will know Bobby Charlton. But it's true. So why are they not spending money on Old Trafford? And who owns it?
Well, the club own the grounds. I mean, they are doing what you might call maintenance. Yeah, they're doing their annual repairs on the grounds.
We're doing that at Sellers Park. Well, as we all know, it's a shithole. Let's just be fair about it. It's that's fine. I love it. It's my dump, if you know what I mean. But the least you'd expect of a club like Old Trafford, of Man United, is that Old Trafford is kept up to scratch. But they're not.
Well, if people are prepared to come and watch the matches and not grumble, then why spend?
Right, okay.
And again, this isn't a criticism of the United fan base. If United are playing at home against a small club such as Brighton or Palace...
Whoa. You speak for yourself.
What are the locals going to do?
Biggest club in South London. Yeah, no, fair point.
What are the locals going to do? They're going to flog their season tickets to tourists.
Yes.
The tourists are just happy that they're there with the selfie sticks.
Yes,
you know, they're there with the half and half scarves, which, you know, you and I have both been to Old Trafford to see our teams play.
Yes, yes.
And we can't believe, you know, who's buying this nonsense? Yeah. And then you look around and there's as many in the home ends as the away ends. So the old school Reds, yeah, they'll still turn up for City and Liverpool and Leeds should they ever get into the Premier League again. But they tend to pick and choose. The football tourists... They're just happy to be there. So they spend all of their time taking photographs. They don't even sit down. I agree with you that the ground itself from an away fan's point of view isn't great. When they do spend money, United, they will spend it on the hospitality boxes and the corporate areas because they can increase the prices. And whilst United do get a lot of stick, some of which is warranted, they've not increased season ticket prices for 8 years.
Okay.
So, still getting 2011 seats at 2011 prices.
I didn't know that. That's laudable. But is that a deliberate decision? That's not a benefactor decision, is it? It's not a generous decision, or is it?
I think it's a common sense decision.
Right.
The owners know that they're not popular. If they were seen to be exploiting the fans, monetizing the fans, as the accountants would call it in the finances, any further, I think things could turn a bit ugly. We've seen what's happened with FC United of Manchester, the splinter club. I mean, I'm a co-owner of FC.
Are you? I didn't know that. So you've got two clubs in. I think we've already discussed that I'm against that sort of thing, but crack, you know. That's fine. In those circumstances, yeah, I think that's fine because they're a different sort of club and they came out of different circumstances. Yeah. So.
And so United haven't felt the need to spend money increasing the quality of the seats. I'm 6 foot three. If I go to Old Trafford, I have to stand up. I mean, I'd stand up anyway.
Yeah, sure.
But I don't have the opportunity to sit down because the seats are so crammed together. They will argue... We've got 76,000 people turning up every week. There isn't a problem.
Well, yeah, sure. So, and they're clearly not skimping on transfers. They've paid a lot of money for transfers, and I presume their wages are relatively high. How long, then, would it take this... My theory is that Solskjaer's a dead man walking, but that's for a different pod. How long would it take for Man United to be outside the Champions League or outside the Europa League or not winning things for... their finances to start being eroded, or are they entirely financed by sponsorship deals, the brand?
Well, I think the issue with United is that their sponsors, it's Chevrolet and Adidas, they will have penalty clauses in those contracts. If you do not qualify for the Champions League, we will... reduce what we're going to give to you. So last year, 2019, United had sales, had revenue of £627 million. Their accounts, there's 1,400 pages of them. On one page, it said next year, we think that the revenue is going to drop to about 560 or 570.
What was the first figure?
627.
That's a lot, isn't it?
So, and that's partly due to they're not in the Champions League, but it's also partly due to the fact that what Manchester United historically have been brilliant at doing is going to different countries and say, do you want to be the official snack supplier of Manchester United in Malaysia? And then they go to Nigeria and do exactly the same. And then they will go to Australia and do exactly the same. And people have always wanted to do that because they say, oh, by the way, a couple of players from the first team squad, they're going to turn up in 3 weeks' time with the Champions League trophy, with the Premier League trophy, and your product's going to go alongside that. They're not in a position to do that anymore. So what we're seeing is commercial income is flatlining. As I've said to you, in terms of match day income, they've kept the prices static. So match day income's flatlining. The only way they're getting extra money is from TV.
Well, thank God there's a lot on that for the Premier League clubs. That's interesting you talk about going to places like Nigeria, because it's always been a source of great amusement to me and many other football fans when you see poor old Ole Gunnar Solskjaer looking more and more like Gollum every week in front of the commercial sponsors board. And every week I'm proud to be associated with Mexico's finest tractors and in association with Thailand's leading jam maker, which is always like, come on, you're Man United, you should be better than this. But the sponsorship is interesting because they've got an interesting sponsor, and I'm kind of glad it's not like most of the clubs, unfortunately, including Palace, a Far Eastern gambling operation. But Chevrolet was kind of a strange sponsor, really, because that's, again, looking out to the world rather than Britain. But rumours that the Chevrolet sponsorship might not last as long as it was going to?
That's right. I think there's 1 or 2 years left on the deal. It was very lucrative. I think it was £567 million over sort of 8 or 9 years. And Chevrolet, as you said, they see Manchester United as a global club, and they're trying to sell cars everywhere, ironically, everywhere apart from the UK, because in 2013, when the deal was signed, Chevrolet sold 11,000 cars in the UK. 2019, this year to date, they've sold 23.
Ha! I'm sorry, that was an inappropriate... Man United fans, I apologise, that was an inappropriate response. It's gone from 11,000 to 23 in the time that they've been sponsoring Man United?
That's correct, yes.
That's astonishing. So that's pretty much 560 million quid down the drain, isn't it?
Well,
in a way.
They will argue that it's still good for sales in the US and it's still good for sales in Australia and Asia. It is rumoured that the person that negotiated the deal didn't survive too long at Chevrolet because the rest of the board of directors said, you've overpaid for this.
I mean, that's like when I ask people why Accrington play at the Wham Stadium and no one can give you an answer, which indicates that it wasn't a particularly clever move on the basis of Wham to sponsor a stadium. I mean, the Chevrolet deal, does that imply that there aren't any... Either that United are looking as a global brand or that there aren't any British companies that can afford that sort of money to sponsor a team like... Are they too big for the English market, if you like?
I think they probably are. If you look at all of the sponsors, how many of them are UK companies in the Premier League? Hardly
any.
We've seen Liverpool with Standard Chartered. They've done very well. They've just renegotiated their deal. I think you will see United going to another American company. I think if they manage to get the same amount of money, then that will actually prove to be pretty decent for a club that finished sixth last season, is going to struggle to get into the Champions League this season unless they win the Europa League.
So when do they start then? If they have financial problems, if sponsorship starts to fall off, as they tried to briefly mention on page whatever it was out of 1,400 pages, if they're sort of tucking away £100 million loss in revenue, when do they start being unable to spend as much on players and on wages? Or do they realise that if they go down that route, that could spiral, lead to even less success on the pitch? Because Man United, it seems to me, are a club that simply can't afford to be outside the top six, simply for the global branding. So they're kind of in a situation where a club like Brighton or Palace, if we're lucky with the owners, we will buy a marquee player every year. United kind of have to do it three or four every year. And also the fans demand that. If you're a Man United fan, you're not going to listen to sensible arguments. As we learnt last week, Newcastle fans don't want to listen to sensible arguments about where they should be in the great scheme of things. Man United fans certainly don't want to listen. As you say, the tourists don't care. But the hardcore fans who still care, and there are billions of them, they simply can't count. You can't say to a Man United fan, look, we have to cut our cloth according to our means if that means we're 12th, 13th. And also that means they will then spiral into decline, won't they?
Well, they could. I mean, if you look to see, you know, we think of Newcastle. Yeah, we were discussing last week, are Newcastle a big club? Yeah. I think Manchester United will always be a big club. I mean, Spurs are now one of the big six. When was the last time Spurs won anything?
Well, yeah, fair point. Well, the league, 1961, so, and that's not looking, that's an interesting point.
So if you have a reputation, I think you can probably get away with it. Liverpool have not yet won the Premier League, and yet they're still considered to be a massive club. They are about to sign a new kit manufacturing deal with Nike or New Balance or whoever it's going to be. And the money involved there is effectively going to be double the expectations of their current deal. So you can, if you've got a legacy, then people will still buy into that because there's still that hand down of supporting a club from parent to child, not only domestically, but also overseas. And United have that benefit on the back of winning the European Cup in 68, on the back of the Munich tragedy and things of that nature. And also the amazing work done by Sir Alex Ferguson, because in the last, when the Glazers came in, his genius was he wasn't spending huge sums of money. Chelsea were on the rise because of Abramovich. You had City coming into the equation as well. Sure. And United was still doing well. Since 2013, there's been this succession of managers. Sir Alex ran it on a relative shoestring compared to what we're seeing.
Oh, it's interesting. Okay.
Because the banks had to be paid.
Oh, now, but he remains a cheerleader for the Glazers, though, doesn't he, Sir Alex?
That's right. I mean, his relationship, I think the fans would absolutely love it if he turned round and was, you know, seen sporting a green and gold scarf. Yeah. But I can't see that happening.
You hear, I'm sorry to interrupt because we need to move on. You hear a lot of pundits, Gary Neville in particular, desperately clinging on to the idea that everything is cyclical, and that United's turn will come again without actually explaining how that's going to happen. Is that the case, or do you think United are now so far behind Liverpool, Man United, Tottenham, even financially, that they won't be able to reach the similar heights with these same people in charge, with the same owners?
To be fair to the Glazers, and it's not often you hear anybody say to that.
Yeah, that's true.
Since Sir Alex,
we tried to be fair to Mike Ashley last week, so we've done worse. To be fair,
since Sir Alex retired, they have spent over £1 billion on players. But if you look at the side that they're putting out, how many of those would get into the Liverpool side or the City side, even the Palace side?
You'd probably
turn down a few of them.
Last year, I'd have taken that as an insult, but we beat them at Old Trafford in a way that would never have happened under any other Man United. Certainly, they equalised in the last minute under Ferguson. When there would have been 10 extra minutes, they would have scored again and we went to score again. That simply wouldn't have happened. And that's an indication of how far United have drifted, I think. But in terms of the Glazers, and you said last week that there weren't many people knocking down Newcastle's door, a figure of roughly £335 million, are United still such a glamorous prospect that there are people still wanting to buy Man United? And if £335 million buys you Newcastle, how much are you going to have to spend on Man United?
Well, Manchester United at present are a relative bargain. I was doing some sums this morning.
Yeah.
Since last August, Manchester United's shares are traded in New York. And since last August, the value of the club on the stock market has fallen by £1,700 million. So you could now, in theory, the stock market price is about $2.6 billion. I should have said dollars rather than pounds.
My ignorance is it's traded in New York because the owners are American and the money was lent by American banks.
Well, partially. There's slightly less scrutiny. Manchester United is actually registered in the Cayman Islands, a place which is not noted for its transparency and governance and things of that nature.
I read Private Eye. I understand. Yes, yeah. Well, funny, it always sets an alarm bell going off, doesn't it, when you read that someone's registered there or the Bahamas or whatever. So.
I think you could buy United today for a lower price than you could have 12 months ago. But I think anybody buying it would also have to say it's going to cost us X hundred million to invest in the squad. United still have the biggest wage bill of any club in the Premier League. They spent £330 million on wages last season. Their average salary is £160,000 a week.
Wow.
Whether that money is being well spent, I think, is very questionable.
This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion. What if you had access to tomorrow's tools today? In Notion, you do. It's the AI-powered workspace where any team can turn ideas into action.
My career is sort of a bit like being a butterfly, and I'm always jumping from project to project. So therefore, Notion helps me from summarising meetings notes and automatically generating action items to getting answers to any question in seconds. If you can think it, you can make it. And Notion is for everyone, whether you're a Fortune 500 company or a freelance football finance lecturer.
You can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, during the AZ Alkmaar game, which until the England-Czech Republic game, I thought was probably the worst game I've seen for quite some time, when the commentators were trying to talk about, you know, it's a young Man United team, it's an experimental Man United team, when Owen Hargreaves, it was, who pointed out at half-time that the average age of that Man United team was a year older than the Alkmaar team, and that it had cost something like £440 million to put together. So when you put those figures together and you're getting nil-nil away at Alkmaar, that isn't good. But just a final question, is there any appetite, do you think, from the Glazers to want to sell in the way that we learned from you last week that Mike Ashley would as soon as you offer him that cheque, he's gone? Are the Glazers in a similar situation, or are they there for the long haul?
I think there is dissent within the Glazer camp. There has been talk, in case over the last few days, of one of the Glazers, Kevin, trying to sell his shares.
He's my favourite Glazer. Now, Kieran Glazer, I've not got a Brighton fan, not happy with him. But Kevin Glazer, great fan.
So I think there's six kids.
Can I just say your look of patience when I interrupt you is a joy to behold. You've got kids, haven't you?
I've got grandkids.
Have you?
Yeah.
Well done. I don't know why you've gone up in my estimation even further now. I already liked you a lot, and now that's almost equaled out the Brighton thing. Eh? This dude's got grandkids.
So there's six Glazer children. And Malcolm Glazer, it was originally his fiefdom. He effectively, when he passed away, though his shareholdings were effectively transferred to the children. Are all of the children interested in football? I think two of them are very keen.
Right, okay.
I think the others, if somebody offers them the right money, they'd sell. What will happen if somebody comes in with a big offer? It'll be like J.R. Ewing and the good old days of Dallas. There'll be an inter-family fight.
Yeah, Google it, kids. You'll be fine. Somebody asked me that. I want to briefly, before we get on to questions from our listeners, and again, thank you for the questions. I'm sorry that we get far more questions than we have time to get through. At the moment, time constraints in the studio mean that we haven't got as long as we want, but we will get to as many questions as we can, and in future we will be led by your question. But somebody did answer me this week about... It's all very well talking about Man United and Newcastle in the Premier League, but they'd like a bit of context. We talk about clubs that are wealthy in the Premier League. There is an assumption that the Premier League is one of the biggest industries in the world because of the amount of publicity it gets, the amount of people that are watching it. There are very few countries that aren't watching Premier League football. But is that necessarily the case? I mean, just give us a little bit of context as to how big the Premier League is as an industry or as a brand.
Well, I think it's a myth that it's a huge industry.
If
you narrow it down, what other businesses do you know that are open 25 or 30 days a year? Yeah, if I go to my local supermarket, I can buy stuff there any day of the week. football ground is open once a fortnight.
I have... Steve Parris would hate you saying that, because at trustee meetings for the foundation, it annoys me so much that... Now, I understand there's corporate stuff to be done and business lunches to be had, but it annoys me so much just in terms of community values that football clubs aren't open 14 days out of 14. It annoys me that there aren't lunch clubs for old people, for people who can't afford lunch. It annoys me that the Samaritans aren't there. So that's a big issue, and something, again, we'll talk about in future. But it's interesting to hear you say that from an asset point of view. It makes no sense either from a business point of view.
No, because how do you make money? You sweat your assets. Well, if you're only sweating them once a fortnight. So I got my big calculator out in advance of this question. And
is that because of the age thing?
That's right. The total money generated by the Premier League since it started in 1992, and football didn't exist before then, apparently.
Of course.
That comes to £47 billion. If you take Bet365, which is one betting company based in Stoke, last year, the total bets received by Bet365 in 1 year, £57 billion.
Wow. That's a genuine wow moment. I'm going to tell the truth now. One of the wows in podcast one was I had to put it on. But that was a genuine wow. So £12 billion...
more.
That's astonishing.
And that's coming from one betting company. You've got Ladbrokes, you've got Paddy Power and others. Other gambling companies are also available.
We'll put that in context. I mean, are they earning? Dulux, for example, would they be a bigger company than the Premier? I mean, that's fascinating. You can't answer that question without. I realise as I asked you that question, even the top finance expert at Liverpool University is not going to be able to say, "Oh yeah, Dulux definitely earning more." Scrap that question from the record, Your Honour. But you talk about generating money. What does that mean exactly? You said it's generated X billion pounds of Premier League. Does that mean for the clubs? So each club has earned a certain amount of money, and that's
right. Clubs generate money from three sources: match day income, broadcasting income.
Yeah,
but so match day is your tickets,
which is the lowest by a long way, I imagine, isn't it?
That's right. Then you've got broadcasting, and then you've got commercial, and it varies from club to club. So for United, they make about 20% of their money from match day. If you drop down to a club such as Bournemouth, it's about 4%. Because it's an 11,000-seater stadium, and they price accordingly. And
I'm genuinely, this is not an insult to Bournemouth, but I'm genuinely surprised it's as much as that for any Premier League club, to be honest, 4%, because you would guess that the commercial on the TV would be huge. So some of us have been labouring under a misapprehension then. This giant global brand isn't actually that significant in terms of finances then, is it?
Yeah, it's a small business with a big voice. Because it dominates the back pages and sometimes the front pages, as we've been seeing in stories breaking recently.
That's interesting. Well, let's get on to, because again, the time is against us. Somebody just tweeted me a question about Man United, funny enough, which... oh, no, they haven't. We'll have to strike that out. It's the Price of Football just tweeted me a question about Man United. That's karma for taking the mickey out of you for having a big screen because you've got grandkids. Let's get questions. Plain old NH is a question.
Oh, yeah.
Is tweeted as a question. And it's a point that some football fans are happy to agree with. The sensible ones, the ones around our age. Plain old NH says, fans have unrealistic expectations. Based on average income for each league, what should the annual wage bill be, and how far away from it are most clubs? And I think that's a question that most, when you talk football finances, immediately most people say players' wages. They always say it's totally skewed by players' wages. So a sensible answer, what are we looking at here? What should their wage bill be, and how far are they from it?
The Premier League's pretty successful because of the broadcasting money and all of the commercial money. Clubs can survive if the average wage was £63,000 a week. The average wage is, in fact, £68,000. So the Premier League overall is losing a little bit of money. But, it's broadly there. I think the big issue is in respect of the Championship. If clubs in the Championship were to break even, then they shouldn't be spending more than $4,500 to $5,000 a week on wages.
Four and a half to five grand a week. For a 22-player squad?
Or yeah, 25-man squad.
They shouldn't be... Wow. They're a lot... Wow.
But the average wage in the Championship, $16,000 a week.
Wow.
And I saw there was an article, I think it was in The Athletic, about QPR this morning.
Yeah.
And the manager, I think Mark Warburton, was saying, we've got some of the lowest paid players in the league. There are some of them on less than £10,000 a week. And you know, I think, you know, perhaps we ought to be setting up a GoFundMe page. you and I, Kevin, if they're on that.
Well, so it was a good question from Plain Old NH. And the answer is a long way away, unfortunately. The final questions, we do have to go. Richard Redmond has tweeted with his question. Is there any follow-up on the Hillsborough sale? And we haven't got a lot of time for you to explain the slightly murky story. He said there were talks of sanctions against Sheffield Wednesday. And he's finished that with love from a concerned blade. So we know where Richard's coming from, but it's either good news or bad news, concerning on your point of view.
Right, to quickly summarise that story, Sheffield Wednesday have been ambitious. They've tried to get into the Premier League. They've lost a lot of money. Therefore, they were potentially in breach of financial fair play. So the owner went and sold Hillsborough to himself for £60 million.
That's all right, is it?
That's all right if Hillsborough is worth £60 million.
Oh.
Because the Reading owners sold the Majeski to themselves. Now, I'm not an expert on property, for £26 million.
Right.
And West Ham sold Upton Park for £40. Now, if you're telling me that property in Sheffield is worth 50% more than London, then I've got some figures in my own head a little bit wrong.
So this is not an independent valuation. This is Sheffield Wednesday value in their own ground.
It's Sheffield Wednesday's independent valuer valuing it at £60 million.
Right, okay. And just to cheer Richard up and maybe depress the Sheffield Wednesday fans listening, what's the potential outcome? Are sanctions likely? Or as you say, this is well within the parameters of what's considered acceptable and is totally legal and above board.
Well, the EFL, they're investigating. They're investigating the sale of Hillsborough for £60 million. They're investigating the sale of Pride Park by Derby to themselves, to the owner, for £80 million. Right. And they're also doing the same in respect of Villa Park.
Well, it's a slightly depressing note on which to end the pod. But unfortunately, when you're talking about football finances, there's probably going to be more depressing notes than optimistic ones. But thank you for listening again. And again, for the third week running, I might have to shave my eyebrows off, basically. It's just going to be much easier. So my hairline's getting further back, so it's getting harder for my eyebrows to actually reach where it used to. Thank you, Kieran Maguire, the brilliant Kieran Maguire, is how I'm going to describe you from now on. The price of football is going to be a little bit longer to tell you because my phone just went off. But we let it out. When we got our guys laughing too much, the producers, that's always a good sign. Could be crying. The Price of Football podcast is a Dapdip production and is recorded at Soho Radio Studios. I'm Kevin Day. That was the brilliant Kieran Maguire. Join us again next week.